One of the key questions you have to ask yourself is, what problem is this event solving? And that's the same for any product, I guess. Again, it's no different. If I launch this, what is the problem that I'm solving?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices. Neither rain nor sleet nor Storm Dennis will stay us about our duties. Thank you to everyone who reminded me last week that we actually forgot to introduce ourselves. So I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I think I'm Peter Houston. And that quote you just heard is from Duncan Siegel, portfolio director at Mash Media, a 25-year-old publishing firm that runs a really interesting mix of magazines and events in the events market. So incredibly meta.
And tickets for the Publisher Podcast Awards close this Wednesday, the 19th of February. So if you want to be there, and you don't have to be nominated to be there, it's going to be a great night anyway. Now is literally your last chance to get them. So head over to publisherpodcastawards.com.
Do it.
It'll be a good night. So as ever, we're going to begin with our news roundup. And I feel like I've got deja vu with this first story, which is that the UK government has announced, quote unquote, ambitious new plans to regulate the internet. This is what, ambitious in the same way that Johnson's Ireland bridge is ambitious, as in completely
slightly less ambitious than that.
So anyway, the Ofcom, which is the UK's existing broadcast regulator, has basically been tasked with moderating everything illegal and slightly untoward on the internet.
It's not, it's just likely to be.
Right, okay,
so I'm going to try and be not cynical about this.
You feeling all right?
No, I am. Because I think this is important. I think it's doomed.
There you go.
I think it's doomed to fail. But I think it's important that the government, that governments, not our government particularly, that all governments, take this shit seriously. So the point of this is that they're trying to set up this idea of a duty of care to protect internet users. Now that, surely every business has a duty of care to protect humans. So there's, as always, full details will be published later. But they're trying to target illegal content related to child exploitation and terrorism and really nasty stuff, and that, you know, that has got to be a good thing. Where it gets weird, I think, is that they're also trying to target harmful content. Now what is that?
Yeah, that seems very, very vague to me. Is that now down to the individual publishers to work out?
Well, so any website or publisher, or sorry, any website or platform has to be totally open about what their code of conduct is, if you like.
Okay.
And then transparent, and then they have to enforce that. So what's acceptable on their site, as they have defined right. It, they have to enforce that.
Okay, so...
This whole thing is mainly targeted at social media companies.
But it's not. No, it absolutely isn't. It's any user-generated content.
In theory, I think they have said that a lot of the larger publishers will be exempt somehow.
I was going to say, because things like platforms that allow user-generated content, I don't know if the comment section of the Mail would actually fall under that.
Yeah, it would. They're saying that sites with user-generated content, which they estimate that 5% of websites have that, would be somehow involved in this. Okay, so... So, in discussing this... We're already confused.
Okay, yeah. So I guess the thing here is, even if comment sections do fall under this, this is going to be like the GDPR, where those are so far down the list of things that Ofcom is going to have to worry about when this kicks in.
Oh,
it's going to spend all its time chasing, you know, Instagram self-harming. Would anti-vax stuff on Facebook classify? Because that's technically harmful content.
But this is ridiculous. As you've just said, this is ridiculous. If you look at the struggle that even like Facebook has had moderating content on its own platform, how the f*** is Ofcom supposed to be responsible?
This is more the thing that no matter what regulations we set in this country, no matter what we say, Facebook and most of these social media platforms, who are the main perpetrators of this, are US companies. So if they, you know, quote, break a law in this country, what are we going to do about it? You know, are we gonna request that Zuckerberg's brought over here and we throw it? Like, that's not going to happen.
What they're the interesting part about this, I think, is that they're talking not just about fining the companies, they're actually talking about introducing some kind of executive responsibility, so that there'll be individuals in local businesses will become responsible and could be fined and potentially jailed.
We can jail Nick Clegg. Finally.
No.
This is so unenforceable. Ofcom would have to hire one person for every person in the UK and just have them stand over their shoulder and look at what they say online for this to work.
But I'm getting back to my non-cynical self. Something's got to change. You both agree with that, right? Something has to change.
Yeah, I don't know. Broadly, I do. My worry is that it will go too far, as I think the Verge article on this points it out really well. The worry is that that regulation will go too far. It's going to lead to too many false positives of content being flagged for this kind of stuff and removed. And if you look at what's happening with YouTube, that is that kind of thing. That those false positives run rampant and they ruin people's careers.
I'm not saying that this is enforceable. I'm saying the sentiment has to be, it's got to be good. And we're going to see more and more of this, right? Germany's just introduced fines up to 50 million euros for companies that don't remove offending content.
Mm. I mean, I think actually Twitter's quite a good example of some of the issues that this throws up. So Twitter have done, I know it's still like a cesspool of haptic garbage most of the time. They believe in free speech and you can say whatever you want to say. But they then say, well, if you are being a crappy person, we're just going to limit the reach of that. And it's the reach that is often the big issue in these cases. So it's not censorship. It's if you're going to do, I mean, it's probably called Twitter jail at the moment. Yeah, if you tweet abusive things to people, you lose some of your privileges rather than that necessarily being taken down, or it becomes invisible and people have to then choose to view it. I don't know if you can, with a global social media platform, introduce plans like this, because enforcement is impossible.
Okay, but imagine what would get downvoted on the Mail Online comment forums.
Decency, human decency.
That's the point. You get these pile-ons, it's never going to work. I heard something really interesting about virality the other day, where if something began to go viral, the algorithm would put a brake on it and stop it going viral, and then it would only be shared if it was valuable. So the virality stops.
But then who then decides that it's allowed through that gate?
That it's
valuable?
The individual users can still share it, but it's not got that tsunami type thing. I don't know.
So it's like a dead man switch almost.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really difficult.
Well, I think it's really difficult as well, because by design, nothing has been set in stone about this yet. You know, it's impossible for us to say, oh, that will work, or this has historically not worked. Because at the moment, as Peter has said, the sentiment is there, and the sentiment is potentially good, but sentiment without practical sort of considerations is nothing. It's pointless.
Absolutely. You know, this ties in to this horrible story over the weekend about Carolyn Flack, which I know we're not going to get into particularly, because we can't add into it, and it's sad. And
there is a debate to be had there about newspapers removing stories and whether that is, you know, ethical, whether that is an attempt to sort of massage their own role in cases like this, but we don't want to have it right now. We don't know that we can add anything.
Be kind, also, people. Be kind.
Absolutely. Be nice to each other, because consequences are real.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye on this Ofcom story, and as soon as anything concrete is published, we'll come back to it. But
that'll be episode 197, I think.
Moving on then, and now a look at the state of the media over on the other side of the world. So Esther, why don't you take us through this one?
Because Chris and I aren't grown up enough to do it properly.
Because I'm the only one that can't do an accent. So yeah, Australia's version of the ABCs is out. That is the Enhanced Media Metrics Australia, or the EMMAs, and they've released some data for 2019. It's quite interesting, because we rarely kind of cover stuff over the other side of the world, and it's just interesting to see comparatively what's going on. So digital news media audiences have grown by 2% year on year, which is good. And print readership is weirdly still really, really strong. So like 7 in 10 Australians still choose print news formats.
How does that compare to here?
In terms of the UK, the UK has a national newspaper circulation of about 10.4 million.
Right.
We have a population of 65 million. So it's about, that's about a 1 in 6. But actually ours has decreased sharply. That's decreased 52.5% over the past 8 years. I don't know, will Australia see the same thing in a few years? Like, are we the canary in the coal mine in that sense?
Also, or? Though, okay, so this is where I kind of have to call bullshit on some of these numbers. Readership is different from circulation.
Mm.
You know, there's that classic pass-on thing that, you know, there's like, well, there's 5 Australians reading the same paper.
That's the basis of the Evening Standards metric.
Oh. I mean, they talk about it as a really concentrated media market, don't they? With, like, Murdochone and everything, and maybe he's, I don't know.
It's apparently, it's the third most concentrated media market after Egypt and China, because Murdoch's News Corp owns 58% of daily newspaper circulation.
So, yeah. So does that mean there's less brands, or does it mean...
Yeah, less brands. There's about 10 major ones.
That's why. I don't know.
Well, I mean, interesting in the fact that Australia has always been seen as kind of this, maybe this isn't the right way to put it, this third English language speaking market.
Yeah.
And you know what's interesting is because it is this kind of huge opportunity for publishers both in the US and the UK as well as for those homegrown ones, I think maybe we should look further into this, see if we can get a guest on maybe to talk about this.
Definitely. Yep,
therefore.
Nice. And now the news in brief, and the big news this week has been that the US local newspaper group McClatchy has filed for bankruptcy to, quote, shed costs of print legacy and speed shift to digital. It ends 163 years of family control, and it's being seen as not the canary in the coal mine, but kind of the end of the beginning of kind of a fundamental shift in ownership in the US.
What's his name? The Newsonomics guy? Oh, Doctor?
Ken Doctor.
Talked about this at the beginning or the end of last year, where he said there was more mergers in the pipeline and more stuff going on.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't the end of McClatchy. There's something going on with the creditors that they're filed in with that are going to do a takeover. So they're not ending any of the brands, they're just kind of, yes, almost switching out the debt. But that was all literally to be confirmed at the end of last week.
And one interesting thing that's been flagged up from this is the fact that the newspaper industry still has a way to go in terms of consolidation to match most other industries. We're only going to see more of this over the next couple of years.
Talking of local news, Archant has launched its first experimental local news website as part of a multi-million pound partnership with Google. So I think that the idea is that these websites will be not bloated with like autoplay and ads and all that stuff that a lot of local news websites in the UK have.
There's an idea.
So yeah, they've got this partnership with Google to try and find a sustainable model for regional journalism in the UK, which is, yeah, it's really interesting. We'll see how that goes.
Oliver Dowden, remember that name, is the UK's 5th culture secretary in 3 years. More strong and stable government from the Conservative Party.
Incredibly confused about who's actually in the cabinet right now.
Sorry, interrupt everybody. Oliver Dowden is out as the UK's 5th culture secretary.
What?
No.
Not yet.
Give it
5 minutes. You can splice that into a future episode.
Yeah, you can keep that for Monday.
It's good news.
Unclench your teeth, Christopher.
And it's good news for DMGT as double-digit digital advertising growth at Mail Online is helping to offset print ad decline across the Mail titles. So a 17%...
You're just trying to pretend you care.
Yeah. A 17% growth year-on-year in digital ad revenue at Mail Online. This is the key part. Offset a 1% decline in print ad revenues, according to the trading update from the Mail and Metro newspaper group DMGT.
Digital dimes and print dollars.
Mm-hmm. And you've got to think, to what extent can that growth continue? I think it's still got some significant headroom. But will it ever have enough? Is there even enough potential there?
I hope not.
Well, exactly, because it's fueled by outrage and unkind stories about Meghan Markle. I don't know.
Anyway, the threat of coronavirus has cancelled Mobile World Congress, which is the world's biggest phone show. It takes over Twitter for, like, goodness knows how many weeks. So organisers have cancelled it after weeks of exhibitors and companies pulling out. And I think it's not just MWC that are having this problem, is it?
No, there's been a few. I've seen, and it's not just kind of the big tech ones, which actually require people to come internationally. Even some of the sort of national events have been cancelled on the back of these fears.
There are some smaller companies I feel really sorry for, because events like this are like the one chance they get during the year to actually showcase their product for journalists and things like that. And this sort of thing really hits them hard.
The Oscars of podcasting? No, not the Publisher Podcasting Awards in March the 4th. London, be there, be square. This is interesting. The first Golden Mics Award is to debut in 2021. There's a group of podcast publishers, Spotify, NPR, PRX, Sony, big names, Wondery. They've announced the formation of the Podcast Academy, like the Oscars Film Academy. It's a membership-based organisation, and it's going to promote podcasting with these awards in 2021.
So we could be in line for a POSCA in a couple of years?
Or would it be a POSCA or would it be a PODSCA?
Finally, the company behind HQ Trivia has shut down. Did either of you ever play HQ Trivia?
Nope.
But I read all the stories about how amazingly, brilliantly the future of humanity it was.
Well, you know what's interesting? It kind of was at the time. When people started jumping on board, it was this huge cultural event. It reinvented the scarcity of live events, so people were constantly tuning in at the given time. And it was a real case study in how kind of that interactive video could work really well. But unfortunately, it's once touted as that kind of shining example. The company's meteoric rise and fall has been attributed to a kind of backroom shenanigans rather than a failure of the format itself.
It's like that art. Do you see the article about how screwed Condé Nast was in the past?
Oh my, yeah. You know what?
Big, long old piece, but it's interesting.
It's fascinating. It just makes me so jealous.
But, that idea of mismanagement rather than whatever structural problems. The point is the structural problems come along and mismanagement becomes exposed.
Yeah, absolutely. And then people start looking at the accounts and go, why were we fueling this jet with cocaine?
This week I spoke to Duncan Siegel, portfolio director at Mash Media. 25 years old this month, the company publishes magazines and runs events for event organisers and is just about to launch Making Publishing Pay. It's a magazine conference targeted specifically at small and medium-sized publishers. But before we got onto that, Duncan told me about the origins and evolution of Mash Media.
We're actually 25 years old this month. In a couple of weeks' time, we were launched by Julian Agostini in his brother's back bedroom, and his background was within the exhibition industry, and he kind of noticed that there was no magazine for the exhibition industry. People told him there was a reason for that, but he persevered, and the rest is history. From driving it around in his Fiat 125 to we're 60 strong people based in Kingston now, so quite some evolution. And over the period of time, he expanded over different event sectors. So from exhibitions into conferences, both in the UK and globally, with a couple of purchases, but mainly through launch. I joined the company in 2010, so just over 10 years ago now. My background's publishing for companies like Haymarket and Centaur. And when I joined, we were a pure play publisher with some events tagged onto the magazine brands, so a couple of awards ceremonies, that kind of thing. We had the opportunity to make some purchases in 2012 for Motion Media, a magazine brand called Access All Areas, which was, well, still is, about the outdoor events community. And we purchased that along with a show called Event Production Show. Once you're in the market, you get offers, and over the next 2 to 3 years, we then bought Confex from UBM and what is now the PA show, which was a mixture of buying a small PA show from Prism Group in Bristol and then office from Diversified. The reason for that was it's not event specific. The PA and EA community are very much involved in organising different types of events, so it sits alongside the other shows quite well.
So see if you go back to one of the first things you were saying there about that kind of reticence in the market to start a publication for events. Why was that? Why was it seen as a difficult market?
Well, I think the main reason for that, and this is borne out on some of the things we'll talk about later, is that there was no community. There was no... The exhibition organisers worked in their own silos, producing their and delivering their events, and they didn't see themselves as part of a community. I think the AEO was setting up back then, the Industry Association, or had just kind of come about, and so they were just starting to kind of be brought together. But because they focused on more on the markets that they created the events for rather than seeing themselves as their own industry. Yeah. And that's changed through how exhibition news has kind of brought the industry together over the last 25 years. You know, when you have that community, you can create magazines and events around it, and they didn't see themselves as that back at the time.
I'm looking at this, and or from my experiences, from a publishing perspective on this, and I know loads of publishers have started more events, but has the events market grown anyway, you know, outside of publishing?
Absolutely, yeah. If you look back to 25 years ago, we this is guesstimated numbers, but we think there are approximately 1,000 trade shows and consumer shows in the UK. If you look now and dug hard enough, you'd probably find in the region of 2,000, because the whole face-to-face, you know, since I've been in publishing in 1996, obviously the internet and digital has come in and taken over a lot of the traditional print, but as well as that, people have experience and now require more of the face-to-face connections that live events give, and that's I think any publisher today should be using events as a staple part of their portfolio. It helps you build better relationships. It gives your clients what they want, which is FaceTime with customers, and it helps you create the market.
It's an interesting thing, that, isn't it? It's almost counterintuitive. You know, the more connected we are, the more we want to stand next to each other and have a chat.
We work in a... I don't think the exhibition industry... I'm focusing here quite a lot on exhibitions, because that's the Exhibition News is one of the portfolios I run, so, and it's one which we're very strong in. But it's not... In terms of the number of companies and the number of suppliers, it's not that big. And you have a lot of, companies... there might be, say, for example, furniture... not the most exciting thing, but an essential component of trade shows. There's probably five or six core suppliers within that market, all competing for the same people. So they have to actively be seen by their customers and cement and forge those relationships all the time. And they do it by being at every event that there is for exhibition professionals. They're more, there's two or three people within that sector who they're more noticeable by their absence from an event than they are by being there.
Is there a real sort of, is there a separation between exhibitions and conferences, or is one always run in conjunction with the other one?
No, you've got, the conference market is very different to the exhibition world, because it's a lot more vast. It's a much bigger industry. A conference or meeting is from two people to 10,000 or beyond that. When you look at some of the big Adobe events that run or Cisco across the globe, but they tend to, conference organisers over the recent times certainly have started developing the exhibition side of it, because it's an extra revenue stream. But really, the people there are mainly there for the learning rather than necessarily meeting or talking to suppliers. So it's kind of they've tended to go down the sponsorship route. But similarly now, if you go to a trade show, the amount of theatres that there are in place at a trade show now, because content is king, and it's no different to a magazine from that front. So the exhibitions need that level of content, because you need the different reasons why someone would attend the show. We're asking for people to spend a day or more, certainly hours, out of the office. Time is precious, so they need to know that if they're going to go to a show, they're going to meet the right new suppliers, they're going to network with the right people, increase their contacts, but also they can learn. So we spend a lot of time looking at what the options are, what do they want, what keeps them awake at night, what scares them about their businesses, and we build content programs around that. The core difference being that trade shows in particular are free to attend. But same as trade magazines, you have to deliver an audience. Once you deliver an audience, you can bring the sellers in, and you create the marketplace.
That comparison between magazines and events, it gets made a lot, but what's the real core of that? The idea that magazine publishers are, I'm just going to say uniquely, but certainly well-placed to start event.
Well, they are well-placed because magazine publishers have a community at their fingertips, which they've built over a period of time. And once you have that community, if they follow you, then you can create things around that. So... I think there's examples I'll talk about later, but that's also why publishers are able to launch events, is because they have the community. But I'd grown up through B2B publishing, and in 2012 when we bought Event Production Show, Julian, my MD, just kind of looked at it and gave it to me. I'd never run an exhibition before. And it was quite a daunting task because you suddenly face, well, you don't really know what you're doing, but you bring in some people who can help you to you know, over the first couple of years, who have done it before, know the physical, logistical elements, but also know the marketplace, which is very, very helpful as you learn it. And it is, you can liken it to, well, why do people read a trade magazine? And therefore, why would people go to a trade show? And it's the same reason. It's education, it's knowledge, it's case studies, it's how to, it's you know, connections with new suppliers. It's how to do their job better. And so the elements are fundamentally the same through a trade magazine and through a trade show. You know, the events that we run, certainly the trade shows, are basically saying, we'll help you run better events. What's, you know, why wouldn't you want to come to that? We'll make you better at your job. And it's the same reason. Read exhibition news, read conference news, read Access All Areas. We'll help you run better events, or more profitable events, or safer events, or whatever the key issue is. We'll help you learn, you know, what, how you can do it better.
I was going to say, if you had any advice for someone, for a magazine publisher or any publisher starting up an event, what would that advice be? I guess the first one is to subscribe to your magazines.
Well, it is. We did a new event a couple of weeks ago called Event Careers Live, which is, you know, we want to help people who are in the industry or want to get into the industry further their careers within the industry. And we spent a lot, we had a lot of students that we deliberately wanted students at the event, and we wanted to make sure that they knew all about our products. And it was quite scary that there were a lot of event management students who weren't overly familiar with some of our brands, and our brands are, should be a staple part of their daily diet when they're studying event management. You know, how else are they going to learn? They're going to learn the basic practices and maybe do some practical work, but how are they going to learn about the industry? Who are the big players? Where are the career opportunities? What are the types of roles they can pursue? And I think that was a real eye-opener for us. And certainly, even where they are taught about event management, exhibitions is not a part of that. You know, and the exhibition industry is huge, not just in the UK but globally. But really, if you read our magazines, of course, and subscribe to our newsletters and the websites. But I think one of the key questions you have to ask yourself is, what problem is this event solving? And that's the same for any product, I guess. Again, it's no different. If I launch this, what is the problem that I'm solving? Or is it, have you just seen a commercial opportunity? Because any idea based purely on your own commercial opportunity possibly isn't ticking the boxes of what your community wants. So like you would with anything, you know, do your due diligence, research your market, and then bring in people who can help you get those events off the ground. And there's a lot of very skilled and experienced freelancers and consultants out there who are willing to help you.
I saw an interesting quote, just, you know, doing a little bit of research. This, if the industry grows, then we grow. I think it was Julian that said that, was it?
Yeah, that's our company motto.
Yeah, as a motto, I think that's really interesting. And it just speaks right to the heart of the kind of B2B aspect of publishing, is that idea that if you're not solving a problem, if you're not helping people be better at their jobs and grow, then you probably don't have a sustainable business. You know, that's a great motto, but how do you go about applying that day to day in the business? How does it shape the business?
Yeah, it's a good question. When we've done a lot of things which are very deliberately targeted on that. A few years ago, we did a few tours of universities to promote the exhibition industry as a career path and make them think about that. We have spoken with a lot of associations and publishers who are key for events generally about why they should have more events in their portfolio and why exhibitions in particular, if they've got that community, are definitely within their potential. So we've deliberately gone out and done that. But we've also looked at the industries and said, well, you know, where are the growth areas? Because, so for example, within exhibitions, there's probably about 25 to 30 large players. It's not dissimilar to the PPA model, really, the 80-20. you know, you've got a host of global and very successful exhibition organisers who can run shows throughout the world and do it very, very well. But there are hundreds of smaller companies who are sweating day in, day out to produce maybe three events. And they do that very well as well, because maybe they're more creative or what have you, but they don't have the buying power. They don't have the clout of the big companies. And it's a lot harder. But those people also don't necessarily see themselves as part of the exhibition industry or as part of the events industry. They see themselves as part of the industry that they run the events for. So it might be retail or hospitality, for example. So we've created events which are purely for those people, which ultimately are based around, you know, we've done an awards scheme, we're launching a conference, so there's learning, we're trying to help them be better at what they do, but also bring them into the exhibition industry and show them they're part of this much bigger industry and community, and there are people ensconced in those communities who can help them run better events. So it's those kind of things which, you know, ultimately, yes, as a publisher, we are commercially minded, but our role is to create the marketplaces where the buyers and sellers do business, and we do that through content and education and those types of things. But it's about, sometimes you've got to go out and find these people to bring them into your community to help it grow. And this EN India Awards in particular has been very, very popular with our venues and supplier customers, because there's 20 to 30, 40 companies who they've not even heard of before.
So that's that idea. If I run a conference on heating and ventilation, I think I'm in the heating and ventilation space, but actually I'm in the event space. That's that. It's bringing those people into the community.
Yeah, I mean, you are. We met this a chap recently who within that market, actually, I think he's to do with boilers and heating. And he's just a one-man band. He's got a weirdly named company called Boiler Room Exhibitions, which possibly is deliberate, but maybe not the right thing. But you know, he's come across what we do, and he's like, you know, I'm running this exhibition at the NEC. I don't really know what I'm doing, and I'm after all the help I can get to help grow it. And that's, you know, he's come to us as the place where he can learn about how to do that better.
So you've got this really tight focus on the events market.
Yeah.
But you're launching an event for publishing, making publishing pay. Why have you looked outside the events niche? Have you just spotted an opportunity, or is there something bigger going on?
Well, there's a tie-in on that, because there's two answers to that question. One is, as publishers, we're a small publishing business. We don't have deep pockets. We don't have people on our payroll who are skilled in specific things that can help us help change our business model. But as publishers, we can look at our products and say, well, I think that this, for example, our websites could be so much more, or we could develop strategies for reader revenue, or we could develop white papers, or, you know, how do we build paywalls and all that kind of stuff. And we don't know how to do that. And we looked outside the market, outside into the market, and said, well, where can we learn how to do that? The PPA do some great events, but again, their business model is focused in two areas. One is independence, and one is on the big players. You can attend some of these events and you can hear about all these things you could do, but actually it scares you, because you don't know how to do it. And that's the key thing. So how do you actually, all these great things that you could be doing, how do you do it? And we looked at the industry and went, well, there is no exhibition where you could go and do that, where you can wander around, meet suppliers, hear from experts, and learn how to actually change your business model and develop new products and new revenue streams. There was the Publishing Expo that faded away about, what, 5 or 6 years ago, maybe more. And no one's, you know, there's a reason for that, but I think this is why with this event we want to make it a practical how-to. We want people to attend it to learn from people who have gone through these changes. So not just saying you should really do this, but actually here's a case study on how you can. Here are the 10 steps you need to follow to develop this product or revenue stream, and hopefully people will, you know, by attending the event, will leave there. Not every session will be relevant, but they might leave there with three core ideas which they can go after and develop, which in a year's time might add a significant amount to their bottom line. And that's what it is. We all hear, you know, display advertising revenues are down and digital's not replicating it or replacing it. So, you know, if you don't do any of these 10 things or some of these 10 things, then you won't be around in 5 years. Well, here's how you can do some of those things and hear it from people who have been through it. The other side of it, the reason we're doing it alongside our trade shows is because over the years, events have become such a huge part of a publisher's portfolio. We get a lot of publishers who send their event staff to Confex, and so we already have some reach into that market. So it made sense to run them alongside as we develop this into potentially into a standalone event on its own.
We had this conversation on the podcast last week, to be honest. That idea that, yeah, the New York Times is doing wonderfully well, but, you know, a B2B publisher in the Midlands is probably not going to be able to do the same sort of things that has given the New York Times its success.
Yeah.
So is it much more nuts and bolts, much more targeted at that kind of medium-sized publisher?
Yeah, absolutely, it is. And if you look at the kind of the subjects of the subject headers, it is how to do this, how to do that, or how this company did that. So, you know, it's not. It is very much that practical how-to element where the case studies will show we started doing this 2 years ago. These are the key steps we did it, and this is how you can do it as well. We launched the event last year as a one-day conference, and we had I've got a chap called Entranta who's returning this year, who's an exhibition organizer by trade, and he basically talked to the industry about how to tap into that community, how to launch an exhibition, and why they should all consider it. One company in the audience actually spoke to him afterwards, set up a couple of consultancy meetings, and is launching, I think, 3 exhibitions this year on the back of attending that session and listening to Ed Tranter. Yeah. That's why the event is set up. Unless that person had attended that event, he wouldn't have considered exhibitions as an option for his business.
It's interesting because I think that's what Pub Expo used to be. And Pub Expo kind of lost its way, I think. It got, you know, that idea, it got big themes and it kind of got subsumed a little bit by the ad tech conference that it ran along beside.
Well, I think that's also, you know, the big companies who were operating in that space 6-7 years ago, you know, they did get rid of a lot of their collateral. And actually, if you look at some of the people speaking at Making Publishing Pay, Dan Pierce is doing a session which I think is one that I think will be amazing. Travel Trade Gazette do some amazing work. They've won awards recently. Yep. But they're a classic example of you know, buying a business out of the megalith that was UBM and completely transforming what was a dying product. Yep. And a lot of that is to do with love. You know, getting a small team around you who are passionate and actually care and really getting underneath the skin of it and giving it new life and breath. And I think we've done similar things with the trade shows. Event Production Show, when we bought it, had actually been cancelled. We got hold of it, we put it back on. I wouldn't say it was the most amazing exhibition in year one, but it certainly has tripled in size since then and has got record numbers. Confex was the same. Also UBM, they tried hard to keep it going. Sometimes it needs a different pair of hands. I think there is a lot to learn from people of that, of those smaller companies who have that passion and care and commitment to making things work.
We always ask our guests at the end of the interview for one media recommendation, a book, a magazine, a newspaper article, a podcast or a film that they would recommend to our listeners.
It's interesting. I mean, I'm quite a... if you're looking for something off the beaten track, I'm not that person. I'm a typical 45-year-old bloke, actually 46 now. You know, my life is, I've ploughed my spare time into my children and their sporting activities. I spend my weekends on the side of netball, cricket and football pitches rather than anything else. And certainly if I'm not doing that, I'm watching adults play sport. So I've got the classics in my locker of things like Gladiator and Forrest Gump, which I'll never tire of watching. But the one thing I guess that I have enjoyed recently, and again, it's well known, but the Peter Crouch podcast, I think, has been superb. It shows a really human nature of a footballer that you don't often see. He doesn't take himself too seriously. I guess that's something he's literally had to grow up with, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's entertaining, and it gives you a real, for someone who loves football, it does give you an insight into what happens behind the scenes, and that's been a really interesting series. Actually, he's on number 2 now as well, so I'll be downloading that soon.
So just a quick shout out to some Twitter friends this week for showing us some love. Adam Timworth, Robin Kwong, Michelle Manafee. We do read these, and it really does make our week to see your recommendations and feedback. So if you tweet us at Media Voices Pod, we will respond with puppy gifts. If you don't want a puppy gift, please take a few minutes just to leave us a rating on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who doesn't want puppy gifts?
And as ever, we are out and about with the Media Voices podcast. Some of us will be at Making Publishing Pay on the 25th and 26th of February. That's in London. And we're running a roundtable on how to launch a podcast. The 3 of us will be in Berlin for the Digital Innovator Summit the 24th and 25th of March. We're doing a live podcast recording to close the conference, which, as we've said before, means we're actually headlining DIS. Boom.
And if you want to stay in contact with us during the week, please do go to voices.media. Our website contains our archive of previous episodes, plus links out to everything that we've been reading and writing. You can also sign up to our newsletter there, which goes out every Wednesday. It contains a link to the latest episode and more of the same. But until next week, when we're going to be back with a fantastic guest, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.